I'm Ali Smith, and you're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're devoting the whole programme to the Man Booker Prize. First awarded in 1969, the Man Booker Prize is recognised as the leading award for literary fiction in the English language. The list of previous winners includes many of the literary giants of the last four decades, from Iris Murdoch to Salman Rushdie, Ian McEwan to Hilary Mantel. Last year, Paul Beattie, author of The Sellout, made history as the first writer from the United States to win the prize. This year's shortlist of six novels was announced in September, and thanks to a long-standing agreement with RNIB, the Booker Foundation again funded the production of Braille, giant print and talking book versions of all the shortlisted titles, ensuring that the tens of thousands of RNIB library members could join the discussion. In the run-up to this year's award ceremony, Robert and I interviewed each of the shortlisted authors. Because we were restricted by time on today's episode, we've had to cut some parts of these interviews out. But if you'd like to listen to the whole thing, then you can find them all on our Audio Boom page. And a quick note, these interviews were all recorded before the winner was announced. So, in no particular order, first up, here's Paul Auster. At over 1,000 pages, Paul Auster's 4321 is the longest book on the shortlist. Not that this stopped the 70-year-old American author from narrating the audiobook version himself. He joined Robert down the line from his home in New York. But first, here's a clip.
4321, a novel by Paul Auster. According to family legend, Ferguson's grandfather departed on foot from his native city of Minsk with 100 rubles sewn into the lining of his jacket. Traveled west to Hamburg through Warsaw and Berlin, and then booked passage on a ship called the Empress of China, which crossed the Atlantic in rough winter storms and sailed into New York Harbor on the first day of the 20th century. While waiting to be interviewed by an immigration official at Ellis Island, he struck up a conversation with a fellow Russian Jew. The man said to him, "Forget the name Reznikov. It won't do you any good here. You need an American name for your new life in America, something with a good American ring to it." Since English was still an alien tongue to Isaac Reznikov in 1900, he asked his older, more experienced compatriot for a suggestion. "Tell them you're Rockefeller," the man said. "You can't go wrong with that." An hour passed, then another hour, and by the time the 19-year-old Reznikov sat down to be questioned by the immigration official, he had forgotten the name the man had told him to give. "Your name?" the official asked. Slapping his head in frustration, the weary immigrant blurted out in Yiddish, "Ich hab vergessen," I've forgotten. And so it was that Isaac Reznikov began his new life in America as Ichabod Ferguson.
The book is a novel. I finished it last year. It's by far the longest novel I've ever written. It's Well, the manuscript, I remember, was over 1,100 pages. I think the British edition is close to 900, but now in the new paperback, it's over 1,000. They've changed the format. So it's a big, big book. And what it tells, essentially, is the story of a young man's life from birth to young adulthood. But what I do in the book is I tell the story four different ways, four different parallel lives for the same person whose name is Archie Ferguson. And that's why the book is so long, because in fact, it's four novels in one.
Did you write each Ferguson individually, or did you write them the way we read it?
No, I wrote it the way you read it, because whenever I write a novel, I start at the beginning and I write the first sentence and then the second sentence and then the third and all the way to the end, because I don't always know what I'm doing, and I need to have the material behind me in order to do the material I'm doing that day. And so I needed to just write it in the order in which you read it.
Now, you say it's a novel, but there are people from your life in it and things that you've experienced in it. So there's part, I don't want to use the word autobiography, but there's autobiographical moments.
Just a few, actually. Even though Archie resembles me in many ways, it's more the fact that we share the same chronology and the same geography. He was born the same year I was. He lives in the same place as I did and later moved to the cities where I've lived myself. But essentially, it's a work of fiction with a few actual events transformed into fiction in the novel. But this is true, I think, for all novelists all the time in every book.
I'm thinking about the Columbia sit-ins.
Yes, I was a student at Columbia, no question about it, at the same time that Ferguson is. But unlike Ferguson, I was not a reporter for the student newspaper. That's something that he does in the novel. So he's reporting on the big revolution of 1968 that took place there. And yes, I did put some real people in there because I thought it was necessary. For example, the leader of the student radical group who led the strike against the university was someone named Mark Rudd, who was someone actually I knew all the way back in high school. And then we went to the same university also. And I asked Mark if I could use his name, and he said, fine. And so I did. But at the time, Mark became a very prominent figure in American life. I think he had his picture on the cover of Newsweek around that time. So he was a known quantity, and I didn't want to fictionalize him.
Now, you said earlier it's a long book, and in turn, of course, it's a long audiobook. 36 hours are
36 and a half hours, I was told.
Now, anyone who doesn't know will think, yes, sitting reading isn't hard, but we know it's intellectually that's a challenge. How was the reading process for you?
It was stretched over 3 weeks. It was, I remember, last August, so a little over a year ago, and I would trek into Manhattan. I live in Brooklyn, so I'd trek into Manhattan every day in the sweltering heat and squish myself into a tiny, tiny studio. It was so small I couldn't even stretch out my legs, and just proceeded to read. And I have to say, one of the things that kept me going was that I have a friend who's a very interesting man who lives in the Midwest, and he spent his life publishing handmade books of mostly poetry, a wonderful person. And this friend is suffering from macular degeneration, and man who spent his whole life reading is no longer able to read. And all through those days, I kept thinking about my friend, Walter Hamady, and that I was actually reading the book for him. And it helped get me through it, I have to say, because I wanted him very much to hear it, because he wasn't any longer able to read it himself. I'm a great believer in spoken word books, the audio books. I have many friends who find it difficult to read for one reason or another, not just poor sight or no sight, but, for example, a number of artists that I know are not great readers, but they like books. And some of them actually listen to my books while they're painting during the day. And I find that very, very nice. And other people enjoy listening to books while they're driving their cars, either commuters or people on long-distance trips. Again and again, I hear from people who say how inspiring they find these audiobooks. It's not a performance, reading a book out loud. It's somehow entering into the rhythms of the prose and articulating it clearly enough so that the listener can grasp what's on the page in his or her ears.
When you're writing, do you stop and read it to yourself as well to find that rhythm?
Yes, I do it all the time. And in fact, I've been married for 36 years to Siri Hustvedt, also a writer, a wonderfully brilliant writer. And all these years, I've always read out loud to her as I'm writing a book. Every 20, 30, or 40 pages, I sit down with her and I read the most recent pages, and it helps me to hear where I've gone wrong. And without reading it out loud, I don't think I would comprehend what I've done as well. So it's very important to me. Yes, writing is a physical activity as much as a mental one, and hearing it articulated by a human voice is essential.
Back to the story. The story is all about what ifs. Did you think about the little decisions in your life and how it's ended up to...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, doesn't everybody? I think what we're talking about, these what ifs, are things that everybody at one time or another thinks about, especially perhaps as you get a little older and you look back on the things that have happened to you. Not only the decisions you've made, but the circumstances that have turned your life in this direction or that. And it's quite remarkable to think about how, for example, I was talking about Siri, my wife, a moment ago. When I met her 36 years ago, she was an absolute stranger to me. And there was only one person in the world we knew in common. And I happened to go to an event at which he was there with her. They were fellow students at Columbia University. And he introduced me to her. Now, if I hadn't gone that night, and I was very tempted not to go, I remember, I never would have met her. Which means not only would the last 36 years have been entirely different, but our 30-year-old daughter never would have been born. And it's difficult not to think about these things whenever you look back on the past.
He had a hard time of it, especially in the beginning. But even after it was no longer the beginning, nothing ever went as he had imagined it would in his adopted country.
Another clip of Paul Auster reading from his novel 4321, which is TB24153. Thanks to Robert and to Paul Auster. You're listening to a special episode of Read On Air, celebrating the 2017 Man Booker Prize. Mohsin Hamid's second novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, was shortlisted for the 2007 Man Booker Prize. And now his latest, Exit West, has made this year's shortlist. A young professional couple flees a city besieged by militants and join a tide of migrants heading west to London and beyond, searching for their place in the world. Mohsin Hamid spoke to me via Skype from his hotel room shortly before the ceremony. Mohsin Hamid's second novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, was shortlisted for the 2007 Man Booker Prize. And now his latest, Exit West, has made this year's shortlist. A young professional couple flees a city besieged by militants and join a tide of migrants heading west to London and beyond, searching for their place in the world. Mohsin Hamid spoke to me via Skype from his hotel room shortly before the ceremony. So your book, Exit West, is very much about a world population on the move and the effects that that has on traditional cultural and social boundaries. It's a very current book, and it has a feeling of almost impending doom about it, and yet it's also very hopeful. That's a difficult balance to strike.
Well, I think that for me, the novel is quite personal, because I've moved around my entire life. I moved to California when I was 3 from my native Pakistan. I moved back to Pakistan at 9. At that point, a California native, totally alien to Pakistan. I moved to America at 18 to study, worked in New York, London at 30, at 38 back to Pakistan. So when people speak of a growing anti-migrant sentiment and sort of xenophobia, I take those issues very personally. I feel that they're about people like me. And so I set out to write a novel some years ago that explored these trends. They have sadly come to seem even more current to us in the wake of Brexit here in the UK and Donald Trump's election in the US. the Syrian refugee crisis. But they've been around for quite some time. And as you say, there's a hopeful nature to the book, because I do believe that human beings have always moved. I think they always will move. I think there's no reason for us to imagine that the migration apocalypse needs to be apocalyptic, that in fact, beautiful new things can come into being. And the novel is about exploring a world such as that.
And I think certainly the relationship between the young couple, Saeed and Nadia, it is emblematic of the fact that two people can come from the same city and have an awful lot in common, and yet they aren't automatically going to fall in love, raise a family and the next generation, that relationships of all types can be more fluid, and one should keep an open mind.
Absolutely. Say the Nadia story is a story of a first love, one that many of us will have experienced. And in a first love, it's two people who are quite different. Nadia is less attracted to tradition, formal spirituality. Say there's a gentler soul, but also a more traditional one. And they're thrown together under very dramatic circumstances as their unnamed city descends into civil war. And in those dramatic circumstances, of course, their initial romance comes to feel dramatic. In the same way that if we are on holiday someplace for 1 week and we meet somebody and we think, oh my goodness, I'm falling in love with this person, the poignancy of it being just for a week adds a heightened sense of emotion and drama to the encounter. If somebody told us instead that we had to live with that person for the rest of our lives in a very small flat, we'd want to flee. And say the Nadia experienced that too. They're thrust together as they migrate and move around the world in very close proximity, and it does result in tension between them. And they change, as we all change. And the novel is about how even when we change, and even in moments of transience, and even among love stories that perhaps do not endure or change, it's still possible to find moments of great beauty in this transience. And in fact, that human life is about transience, and that those who tell us of permanence and that things won't change are really charlatans. That in fact, it's much better, as say the Nadia do, to see what beauty can be found despite change.
There's a lovely quote in the book, that we are all migrants through time. And through our lives, we are migrating from one situation to another, and we have to be mutable or we don't progress. You build empathy very effectively through the book, also with little vignettes of people from around the world who are experiencing similar, if not the same, feelings as Saeed and Nadia at the same time. It's a very international book.
It is. I think that I'm interested in moving beyond the notion that some people are migrants and some are natives. Mm. I think that to be a migrant is the fundamental state of a human life. We are all migrants. And in fact, what we're seeing is really a crisis in humanity's self-conception as migrants. And that's giving rise to a lot of what we think of today as anti-migrant sentiment. And what I mean by that is, if you are an old woman, perhaps born in London 80 years ago in the year 1937, and you've lived in the same house in London your entire life, you were born at a time before the Second World War, you endured the Blitz, perhaps in the countryside, you returned in the 40s and 50s as the reconstruction of the capital and the country were taking place. You witnessed the arrival of people from different places who'd come to work in the factories and the shops and the buses of the UK. You grew old, the city changed, and today when you step outside your house, you see young people who look very different from the way they did. You hear languages that are perhaps not English spoken around you. You see your own children and grandchildren grown up. Your friends have dispersed. Many will have passed away. And instead of going out and being noticed perhaps as a beautiful young woman, you are in fact ignored as elderly people everywhere are ignored and no longer the subject of the gaze. of those who pass them on the street. And your experience is that of a migrant. The city of your childhood is gone. The friends of your childhood have dispersed. The experiences of childhood are no more. And I think someone like that has equally experienced a migration, and that it's important to expand our sense of empathy to include everyone, and to find ways of uniting and dealing with this shared melancholic, but also remarkably powerful and emotional human journey.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. As many of us know, people with sight loss have a limited choice of books available in accessible formats. We often have to wait much longer than our sighted peers for books to be made available, and there are many titles that will never be made accessible. RNIB is working closely with the Booker Prize Foundation to change this story. Emily Friedland is one of two debut novelists on this year's Man Booker shortlist. History of Wolves is a disturbing coming-of-age novel set within an abusive religious cult. She spoke to Robert on a mobile from the woods outside her home in upstate New York. And Robert asked her, as an American novelist, was she aware of the Booker Prize?
Growing up, I was aware of it, had loved some of the prize winners. In particular, I loved reading Court Day's book, Disgrace, and Margaret Atwood, and Iris Murdoch. There were some writers that meant a lot to me when I was growing up to read them, and I did become aware of them often through the Booker. But I was certainly more aware of the American prizes, like the Pulitzer, the National Book Award. That being said, I think it's wonderful in a lot of ways to have the prize open up to all writers of English, and to have all these books from places all around the world set side by side in conversation.
How surprised were you when History of Wolves made it onto the long list?
I was very surprised, very, very surprised. I did not expect it at all. I wasn't even paying that close of attention because I was, at the time, very pregnant right before the prize was announced. And then I was actually in the hospital giving birth to my son when I heard the news about my book being on a long list. So I was in labor, and I got a call from my agent, and she left a message, but she didn't say what she wanted to talk to me about. And I got a couple emails from my UK editor, but I didn't respond because I was in labor and otherwise occupied. So it wasn't until a day or so later when I had the chance to write back that I had the news, and I had my newborn son in my arms, and so I had a lot to sort of take in at once. He was about 7 weeks when I found out about the short list, so I was still very deeply absorbed in childcare and thinking about just how to keep a little human being alive for the first time in my life. I hadn't been a mother before, so was learning about childcare more than I was thinking about books at that moment.
It's not that I never think about Paul. He comes to me occasionally before I'm fully awake, though I almost never remember what he said or what I did or didn't do to him. In my mind, the kid just plops down into my lap. Boom. That's how I know it's him. There's no interest in me, no hesitation. We're sitting in the nature center on a late afternoon like any other, and his body moves automatically toward mine, not out of love or respect, but simply because he hasn't yet learned the etiquette of minding where his body stops and another begins. He's 4. He's got an owl puzzle to do. Don't talk to him. I don't.
So it is a novel that takes the voice of an adult woman, Linda, looking back on a few influential years in her life when she was 14 and 15 years old. Linda was born into the Sacramento commune that broke up when she was very young, before she can really remember, actually. So So she grew up with the people she thinks are her parents on this little lake in a on the edge of a little town in the middle of the North Woods of Minnesota. And when she was about 14 and 15, two sets of events puncture her isolation. The first is a history teacher, a new history teacher comes into town and replaces her teacher who dies. And the second set of events occur when a family moves in across the lake from where she lives. And Linda becomes a babysitter for their little boy, Paul, who's about 4 years old, and increasingly sort of insinuates herself into that family. And as she does, she begins to sense that something is not quite right. But for a lot of reasons, because of her youth and her isolation, she sort of allows herself not to see exactly what's going on in that family until it's too late.
Now, you wrote this when you weren't a mother, and now you are. Has your motherhood changed your view of a very painful thing that happens in the book?
That's a very good question. Yes, you're right. I felt like before I was a mother, before I was pregnant, I had to warn people a little bit, especially mothers, about the events in the book. I'm not revealing too much to say that tragedy, you know, befalls this little boy at the heart of the book. Because I talk about that actually in the first few pages. I do feel somewhat differently now. I feel like it's still, and perhaps even more, important to write about the ways in which parents in particular, often through the best of intentions, actually can do harm to their children. And there's a lot related to that theme in the book, not just the family that Linda babysits for. They're not the only ones who sort of find themselves through well-intentioned beliefs potentially hurting their child. But Linda herself, because of her commune past, finds herself suffering because of her parents' incredibly high ideals and the failure of those ideals. And so I was thinking a lot in the book about parents and not just neglect, but kind of the opposite, actually, too, the way in which parents project onto their children their own desires and dreams and hopes, and how devastating that can occasionally be for children. So I think those themes and those ideas are still really important to me. Maybe even more important to me as a new mother. But I also would say, you know, I'm working on another book now, just beginning, and I find myself as a new mother just really, really wanting to also, alongside offering these kinds of warnings that I did in my first book, I also want to talk about just how beautiful the world is and not just the dark parts. If that makes sense, there's something about wanting to leave a legacy of hope.
Emily Friedland, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, a true pleasure.
Outside the window, an avalanche of poplar fluff floats by, silent and weightless as air. The sunlight shifts, the puzzle cleaves into an owl and comes apart again. I prod Paul to standing. Time to go. It's time.
A clip of Caitlin Thorburn reading History of Wolves by Emily Friedland, which is TB24120, thanks to Robert and to Emily Friedland. In this special edition of Read On Air, we're celebrating the authors on the 2017 Man Booker Prize shortlist. George Saunders' novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, is a tale of magical realism that takes the death of President Lincoln's son as its starting point. Beyond the grave in a transitional realm known as the Bardo, a monumental struggle erupts for the control of the boy's soul. George joined Robert down the line from his hotel room shortly before the Man Booker ceremony began.
It's a novel and it all takes place on one night. And the idea is based on an anecdote I heard many years ago, and this the anecdote is this. Abraham Lincoln, when he was president during the Civil War, lost his son. His 11-year-old son died of typhoid. And the newspaper accounts at the time said that he'd been so grief-stricken that he actually went into the grave or the crypt on several occasions to sort of interact with the body. Some accounts said he actually picked it up. So I heard that about 20 years ago, and it just stayed with me all this time. And I, you know, didn't really think I could write it. And then about 2012, I just decided that, you know, if it had been on my mind that long, I should give it a try. So the book is really just that night on which Lincoln comes to this place called Oak Hill Cemetery in Washington, D.C., and he enters the crypt, and then, you know, hilarity ensues.
Now, you're not known to be a religious writer, but what is a bardo?
Well, bardo is a Tibetan word that means transitional state. So we're in one right now, you know, a transition between birth and death. And there are several others, but the book is concerned with the transition between the zone between the moment of your death and then whatever comes next, which in the Tibetan tradition would be, of course, reincarnation. But if you're a Christian, it might be heaven or hell. So bardo kind of means that. And then I also took it to mean, you know, Lincoln himself was in a transition. He had to sort of quickly go from being a grieving father back to being a kind of active president. So the night is sort of a almost like a, you know, for him, a chance to sort of take a breath and try to get back into the real world and out of that graveyard.
And the structure of the book, it's almost like you've invented a new form, and it hasn't been written, it's been crafted almost. Tell us about how you decided on that structure.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wouldn't say decided, unless decided was defined as, you know, kind of messing around for 3 or 4 months or maybe even a year. I think... for me, I tried this book in a more traditional way many years ago, kind of a standard third-person narration, and it just didn't have any life in it, you know. And I mostly write short stories, and the one thing I've learned is if it's boring for me, it's going to be boring for the reader. So, or, you know, Flannery O'Connor, this great American writer, said once, a person can choose what he writes, but he can't choose what he makes live. So for me, the compositional method is always to just try to find a way to tell the story that makes me happy and makes me maybe confused and excited. So the short version is this was just a product of mucking around trying to find a way to tell the story that was interesting to me. And in the end, the solution was to let it be this kind of chorus of monologue, partly, I think, because, you know, in a sense, to me, that's the truest version of human life is bunch of monologues. You know, if I look out the window here in London, there's 40 or 50 people walking by. The God's eye view of that is actually just 40 inner monologues, you know, at once. Sometimes they contradict each other. Sometimes they don't seem to even be observing the same reality. But it was just an exciting way for me to tell the story. It almost looks like a screenplay, some people have said, or a theatrical script.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the Braille version to see how it's translated to... a tactile form, but it certainly doesn't. Well, the audio version couldn't be narrated by just one person, could it?
Well, that was the plan, and I just was so terrified of that because I can only do maybe 2 or 3 distinct voices. You know, I can do a guy from Brooklyn and, you know, a southern voice and a duck or something like that. So I didn't want to do it. So we had this wonderful young woman named Kelly Gilday in Los Angeles had the idea that maybe we could enlist actors, and she actually went off and made a spreadsheet, and she came back on the phone and said, well, we'll need 166 people. I said, well, can we get that? She said, well, we can try. So we got some really wonderful professional actors, and then some voice actors, and then some people from Random House, and my agent, and then we got my family members, and so we just barely made the 166, but there's not a single double voice on the tape. So in other words, every voice that's in the book is represented by a distinct actor in the audiobook.
She is here, still here. It was as if a rushing river had routed itself through my house, which was pervaded now by a freshwater scent and the awareness of something lavish, natural, and breathtaking, always moving nearby. At dinner one evening, unprompted, before a group of my friends, she sang my praises, said I was a good man, thoughtful, intelligent, kind. As our eyes met, I saw that she had spoken in earnest. Next day, she left a note on my desk. Although shyness prevented her from expressing this sentiment in speech or action, the note said, my kindness to her had resulted in an effect much to be desired. She was happy, was indeed comfortable in our home, and desired, as she put it, to expand the frontiers of our happiness together in that intimate way to which I am as yet a stranger.
And would we know some of the actors who are involved?
Yes, I think Ben Stiller, Susan Sarandon, Don Cheadle, Miranda July, Nick Offerman, and Megan Mullally, and then David Sedaris plays one of the main parts. So it's quite a list. Maybe, probably, I would say 20 or 30 very famous actors are kind of headlining.
And they all recorded their lines individually.
That's right. They were never in the same. None of us were in the studio at the same time, and I think they ended up using. I think she told me 11 different locations. She would Skype. You know, you could go to Minneapolis and Skype in, and my parents went to New Orleans and Skyped in. So it was a Herculean effort, but not by me. Someone else did it all.
Have you read the audio versions of your previous work?
Well, I had 10th of December, and then I think I did one other version. I did two other books. I didn't get through the whole catalog yet, but yeah, 10th of December was kind of the most highly produced one.
And when you're actually writing, is hearing it out loud, even internally, important to the writing process?
It's very important. I'm from Chicago, and for me, the kind of entrance into writing was to understand it as a form of performance. So when we were kids, we did a lot of kind of, you know, improvising and impersonating and that kind of thing. So I had a long time in my life when I was younger where I couldn't figure out how to write, really. I had a little bit of a false version of how to do it. But as soon as I thought, oh, yeah, it's just a performance, then it was easy. I don't usually read, well, as you say, internally is more correct. I don't read aloud. You know, there's that little voice in your head that is a little actually more subtle than your speaking voice, you know, and can get into different registers and do different accents. So that voice is very active for me. So I tend to write, and then as I'm reading, I'm hearing that voice in my mind and adjusting the text to match the voice and so on. And then also, I've been, you know, when I go to colleges or I travel, I do, I try to develop performance versions of the stories where I learn to do the voices as well as I can and then kind of go back and forth to make it live.
George Sanders, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Robert and to George Saunders. Lincoln in the Bardo is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB23946. The Man Booker Prize is renowned for throwing up surprises, and this year was no exception. Elmet is the debut novel from 27-year-old Fiona Moseley. It hadn't even been published when it joined the long list. It's a haunting tale set in rural Yorkshire, full of natural imagery, folklore, and the threat of violence. I read it in a single sitting and had the pleasure of interviewing Fiona down the line from her home near York. So, Fiona Moseley, welcome to Read On Air.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
For those who haven't read Elmet yet, can you tell us a little bit about the background and the plot?
Yeah, so it's about a family living on the margins of society in the West Riding of Yorkshire, and they build a house for themselves on land they don't own. They don't have a home, so they build themselves one, and they live off the land, and they hunt, and they fish, and they forage, and live a sort of self-sufficient lifestyle. But then the local landowners get a hint of what they're doing, and they sort of try to kick them off the land. And the local community rallies behind them. And this conflict goes on for a while, and then it comes to a dramatic climax, which I won't give away.
It certainly is a very dramatic climax, and it's certainly not a disappointing read at all. It kept me gripped. It's not often I'll read a book in a day, but...
Oh, good. I'm glad.
And actually, there is a rather a sense of the Wild West Ridings about it. It's got a bit of a Western feel, hasn't it?
Yeah, I deliberately set out to do something like that. I mean, I'm very influenced by Westerns. I grew up watching them and reading them. And yes, it's a dispute over a piece of land, which is a classic theme for a Western. And there are sort of, you know, hard men pitted against each other. It's about individuals versus communities. Individuals and communities both in relationship to the landscape and the natural world. And then, yeah, there's a showdown at the end. So it is a Western, really, in West Yorkshire.
And also the aspect of the character Daddy, who is a bare-knuckle fighter, a hard man, but who doesn't want to be anybody else's man. He wants to be himself. And yet, in some ways, he's a commodity to other people around him, isn't he?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to explore that. I mean, his thing is that he's incredibly large. He's, you know, probably huge and extremely strong. And he's looking just for ownership over his own body, I suppose. You know, his muscles are being used by other people to do their dirty work. And his one concern, I suppose, is that he just, you know, he has control over what he does and control over his strengths and things. So that's his personal struggle, I suppose, in the book.
And he's removed his two young children, Daniel, who's the narrator, and Kathy, who's Daniel's slightly older sister, to the margins of society to protect them from the dark aspects of society.
Yeah, he's got he's faced with a terrible problem, really, I suppose, because he has his own way in the world, and he's very strong, and he has these two children who he loves very much, and he doesn't quite understand how they could possibly survive without his strength. So his solution is to take them away somewhere and try and kind of build their resilience. And I mean, that has mixed outcomes, I suppose. But it is very much the story of a father wanting to protect his children and not necessarily realizing that he has to let them find their own path and their own way in the world.
One aspect that I loved about the book is that, with the exception of cars and the train line, which figure in the book, actually it could be set any time in the last 250 years. There are no mobile phones, no modern communications.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to keep it kind of timeless. And also, I mean, I didn't know how long it was going to take me to finish it. And technology changes so much that you can almost find yourself being out of date by the time you finish a novel. You know, you might have mentioned something at the beginning that is suddenly irrelevant at the end. And I didn't want to do that. And also, you know, I was living in London at the time when I started writing it, and it really was an escape to rural Yorkshire and sort of the landscape I grew up in. And I didn't want that to be polluted by too many mobile phones and laptops and televisions. So it's kind of free from all that, and their pastimes include, you know, sort of making furniture from the wood around and building their house.
I believe you actually wrote part, if not all, of the book on your phone when you were commuting backwards and forwards to London.
Yeah, so ironically, yeah. I mean, I did a little bit that way. So I started it when I'd been visiting York, which is where my parents live, and I was on the train back down to London early in the morning, and I started it then, and my mobile phone happened to be what I had at hand. Most of the novel was then written on you know, pen and paper or on a laptop, as is normal. But I would occasionally jot down ideas on my phone, although phones don't feature in the book, as you say.
The book is also steeped in folklore and history and the sense that the landscape is older than the humans around it and will probably outlive us too. You're studying medieval history as well, I believe, at the moment.
Yes, I am. I'm doing a PhD in medieval history. It's a cross between history and literature that I'm doing. And a lot of that seeped into Elmet. I mean, the very name of the book, Elmet, that comes from it was the name for the old Celtic kingdom that existed in that part of the world. I suppose I wanted to give it that name to show that the boundaries of the landscape have not always been the same, and they will not always go on to be the same. So I wanted to give the land a sense of timelessness and antiquity, and have this sort of very, very local story, which doesn't span a great long period of time or anything, but it's fixed within a place which is much older.
But you must be delighted that your book is reaching such a wide audience of people who might not be able to see it or access it in another way.
Yeah, I'm really, really pleased, actually. I think it's wonderful that books can be consumed in all sorts of different formats now, either on the printed page or in braille format, or with audio books. And I suppose the point of fiction is that it does transport things that first existed in my mind into the minds of others, and that's into their imaginations, and that's a really wonderful aspect of it.
You're listening to a special episode of Read On Air, celebrating the 2017 Man Booker Prize. And last but not least, Ali Smith is no stranger to the Man Booker Prize. Autumn is the fourth of her novels to be shortlisted. It's set during autumn 2016, shortly after the EU referendum. Daniel is 101 years old and reflecting on his past. Elizabeth, born in 1984, has a wary eye on her future in a Britain that seems more divided than ever before. So, Ali Smith, welcome to Read On Air.
Thank you, Red. I'm so glad to be here.
Autumn, obviously, is very much the season of great changes, and central to the book Autumn is the post-Brexit feeling in the UK. Did you feel compelled to write the book?
I've been thinking about writing these books. There are going to be four books, all named just simply after the seasons, and I now know for sure I've been thinking about them for about 20 years, but I always thought I would do them when I was really, really old, which of course means I'm probably really old now. I don't know how these things come on us. Anyway, the reason I went with it is because I had discovered in the novel before writing this one that publishers could produce a book in its finished form very, very fast, and that the long time you usually have to wait for a manuscript to turn into a book isn't necessary. So I said to my publishers, well, that's really exciting. That's like when the Victorian novelists wrote their novels. They wrote them on the hop, as it were. They wrote them, you know, kind of racing ahead of themselves. They published them as they wrote them. How about if we tried to write something that was really contemporary, published it right up against the time about which it is, the time about which it's written, and is that possible? And they said, OK, we'll give it a go. So I started writing it, and then the Brexit process, as it were, started to happen, and then I realised that maybe books are more mysterious than we think, and that they have their own demands on us that we don't know they're going to make until we actually start writing them. So I went with it, and I wrote the time as the time was happening. And that's how this book has come about, and the other three coming after it will also be to some extent contemporary in the same vein, with any luck. And of course, the thing about the novel as a form anyway is that it's really about time and how time passes. And the thing about the seasons is that they remind us that time isn't just one day to the next, it's cyclic. It goes around in big circles inside us. So we remember all the autumns when we encounter in autumn. So it was an interesting experience to know that we were right up against the glass ceiling of Brexit, and everything was about to shatter into what? Who knows? And at the same time, you've got this sense of dimension about the dimension of time, the longness, the profundity of time, the depth of time, as well as the surface on which we all live.
And certainly that was a touchstone I kept coming back to in some of the darker moments of the novel, and there are some very dark reflections on the division that has been caused by Brexit. There are lots of metaphors of division and lots of images of division within the book, and yet there's also a lot of humour, and a lot of that humour plays with the fact that this is a cyclical process, that the world will not end just because of the Brexit vote, I found myself laughing and gasping at the same time.
That's lovely. I like that description of the book. I like it because it has hope at its core, as time does, because time does pass. And it, with any luck, it's also uncompromising enough to be truthful to the very difficult things that Brexit hasn't just caused, but has revealed in the country, the divides, the divisions, not just in this country, but the divides and divisions that we now know are worldwide, you know, and that have been there for all the years and not been attended to. And so Brexit, in a way, is just, it's like the revelation of it. The book I began to write before we were sure the Brexit process was happening was already full of questions about the mass movement of people across the world, how we relive, you know, how we live in a world which is shifting so fundamentally, and how we do this in a humane way is was always, I think, at the basis of this novel, this story. But really, really, at the basis of it is dialogue, talking to people that you don't know. And, you know, the life that comes from dialogue, from talking to someone else, from multilogue, from the conversations that form us as people and that teach us as people and that allow us to know how alive we are.
And actually in the book you do use the expression the end of dialogue, and then in the next sentence talk about democracy having become like a broken bottle that you can threaten somebody with. I wondered, in amongst the lists that you have there, the Google search type of language that bubbles up through some of the narrative, if you feel that people have got too much choice, they're endlessly looking for an answer, and so they go for a knee-jerk response and become absolutist one way or the other.
Oh, I think we're living in times that are asking us to be binary, that ask us to tick a box to suggest who we are, you know, to hold up a passport, and this is supposed to mean us. This little piece of, you know, this little set of pieces of paper in a little cover means us. We are human. We are multivalent. We are layered. We are fascinating. We are not what we see on a screen or what we live with on a surface. We are dimensional, and I think that the use of language generally reminds us to be dimensional wherever we encounter it, in whatever form, because it asks us to think about meaning. So we just have to look twice or three times or whatever it is that language is doing, and we know where we are with what language is asking of us, or you know, what the uses of language are that are being foisted upon us or offered to us. And that's why, in a way, the literary project is so important, because the novel as a form has always been about newness and about how we live and society, all those things, and about time and about the time in which we live. So if we look to the novel, we'll remind ourselves of our own dimension.
And you do something very novel with this book that I hadn't come across before. The third character in the book is Pauline Boaty, who's a real-life character who was the female pop artist, the only female pop artist in the UK in the 1960s. And you describe beautifully her art, for which I'm very grateful. I can't see it, and to have it described for me is wonderful. But actually, I suddenly realised that your book is also a collage, a montage of what you've seen around you, of your reflection of the debate over Brexit and how people are approaching it. And I suddenly saw it as a picture rather than the book.
Oh, that's a lovely, I love you talking about my book. Please always be the person who talks about my book on the air.
You carry on writing them.
because Pauline Boaty, as you say, a real life person who died very young. She died at the age of 28 in the mid 60s, 1966. She was not only the pretty much one and only female pop artist that we have had in this country. She was also a kind of beautiful force of energy and of dynamism and of excitement and of articulacy. Really early on in the changes that were coming through the 60s, Boti was one of the speakers and the visions of what was possible for us all, but particularly for women at this point in juncture. And one of the things she did was respond with all her thought, heart and spirit to the contemporary. And so her work is full of contemporary reference and collage, which holds together Missiles and Kennedy and Elvis and Marilyn and the Beatles and Fellini and the things which were happening all around her at the time that were becoming famous because of the way in which the images of them were being proliferated. And what Boti does, it's so brilliantly simple. She addresses the image, she repaints, reimagines the image that we think we've seen a thousand, a million times, or we've heard about and we think we understand and we know. She reimagined it and she re-presented it. Now, one of the joys of what you've just said to me about the workings of this book is that actually none of us can see any of Boti's work because none of it's publicly available to see at all. So the descriptions of them, the notion that that's a gift of Boti to out into the world is just, I think, that's a lovely thing. It's kind of filled my heart with, yeah, that was good, that was right. To me, it's a crime that we don't have her work available. Her work exists in private collections, and there's one that exists at the Tate, which has now been, it was out for a while at Liverpool, and has just been put back into storage. And it is the most spine-tinglingly beautiful thing to see and to be near or to have described to you, and I wish it was more available, but here we go. That's good. There's a payoff to this book, which is that we're making those pictures available in all the ways.
Because we were restricted by time on today's episode, we've had to cut some parts of these interviews out. But if you'd like to listen to the whole thing, then you can find them all on our Audioboom page, details of which in a moment. So that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all the shortlisted authors from this year's Man Booker Prize, and to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and ideas for books that I should read. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait till then, why not head to our Audioboom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and author interviews. Simply go to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio. So, until next week, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.